Hello, friend. Welcome to Mr. Rewatch, your Mr. Robot recap podcast, brought to you by a retired stand-up comedian, an exuberant detective, and producer Dave. Hi, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Devlin.
And I'm producer Dave.
It's been a while.
Quite a while, right?
We got the band back together for a very special episode.
Aw, that's so nice. My little Grinch heart grows three sizes this day.
Oh, you stole the reference I was going to make.
Really?
I don't have that many Christmas movies we've seen. Aside from this, it's just going to be like, Kevin. I digress. It is very good to see all of you again. Because it has been a bit of a long time since we recorded last.
That's true. What do you folks do now that we don't spend several hours a week annotating Mr. Robot episodes? Producer Dave, I feel like you have the biggest life news.
I've been domesticated. I have a wife and a child. A beautiful, beautiful baby. He's like a year and a half old now. It's crazy. It's been a wild ride.
That's wild. I don't know where time goes.
Actually, I was thinking about that. When was the last time we recorded? We recorded at the end of the show, right?
At the end of the show. And then I remember we made a bit of special content when we were in lockdown, because that's when I ate the Jungle's roll for that video.
Right. But lockdown was when I kind of lost track of all time, and I don't really remember how long ago that was.
I think it's been like almost 4 years, because Mr. Robot season 4 is also a Christmas episode.
Yeah, yeah. And I actually think of Christmas and like the Christmas episodes of Mr. Robot every time the season comes around.
I really should rewatch it. It has been a while. Since we started making the show, I don't know. I was in lockdown for a while, and now I just work, and I grow tomatoes.
You also went to Vegas for DEF CON, right? A hacker conference that Elliot might have been to.
That's true. I did a return tour to the, I think that's the Mojave Desert. And I still have not learned how to write a single line of code.
It just starts with the pound sign and an exclamation point. The rest there is up to you. So we're here to talk about Leave the World Behind, right? The new movie from Sam Esmail.
And we are going to thank Martin Wallstrom, historian, longtime listener, and for asking if we were going to make this episode. So thanks for encouraging us to, well, get the band back together. And so people who know me know that I only watch 3 movies a year. This was my fourth one.
And the first two were Barbie and Oppenheimer?
And the Bob's Burgers movie. Oh, no, I didn't see Oppenheimer. I went to that new Wes Anderson movie.
Oh, yeah, I actually saw that with you. I mean, we're getting a little bit off track here. But
yeah, I watched this movie, and I liked it.
Mm-hmm. When you went into this movie, did you have any kind of expectations? Have you read the book, Leave the World Behind, before?
So I didn't know that it was a book until after I had finished. But for other folks who might have been aware of that, we are actually going to do a giveaway of a copy of the audiobook if people do want to read the novel. And the novel is written independent of Mr. Robot, but in the movie it does take place in the Mr. Robot universe.
Sam Esmail has said it much. And I think the book, it's quite similar to the TV show, but there are some kind of discrepancies that we'll go over as we talk about the plot. Both of them are very good. And like you, I also saw the movie before getting into the book. And to be honest, I'm only halfway through it. But so far, so good.
Were you two, after we kind of referenced the pandemic and lockdown and things, were you ready for like an end of the world story?
What I felt was that like now is the perfect time for it, because it really kind of connects us with feelings that we've had over the past little while, but not really been able to, you know, like articulate in a solid way. I think that it actually kind of gave us a lot of sentiments that we could connect to as an audience, and it really like described what we all were going through during that time.
I did like that the theme is Joey Badass, who's also someone I haven't thought about for a second.
I never took them off my playlist.
I like, and as in the opening, you see the Statue of Liberty, so you also know it's a New York story and that's where it's situated. So the first thing I notice about this, and I've seen other people notice it too, is that so Julia Roberts and family, they're supposed to live in Park Slope, which is like sort of an affluent like part of Brooklyn, but there's this like big crack down the wall in her bedroom, and I was like, oh, I wonder if they're just kind of like putting on airs about being like wealthy, or if that's just, you know, character.
Oh, because you kind of see that as like the cracks beginning to come out of the facade.
Yeah. And so you sort of see that like their kind of perfect life is not as perfect as you think. And they are, for whatever reason, desperate to get out of the city. And so Julia Roberts, the character's name is Amanda. I actually, in my notes several times, refer to her as Karen. So I'll use those names interchangeably.
That is something I was planning to talk about later. But yeah, I think this is kind of showing us a bit of like an ordinary life that we could all experience, but it also is drawing attention to how mundane it is and how there's kind of a desire for escape to see something else, but then wonder what that else could be.
Yeah. And so right away, so she's impulse rented a beach house. My first question is, why is it so cheap? But I guess we find out later. We do see the family traveling. There's no mysterious businessman in the road.
I was thinking a lot about the cinematography as they're driving down to this cottage, because they use some of those like overhead drone shots that are reminiscent of The Shining. I think that Dave and I had a discussion about that in one of the previous episodes where they were driving out to the farmhouse in Mr. Robot.
They talk a little bit about wondering who owns that house, and they're like, oh, it just must be one of those cybersecurity guys, which I thought was sort of another nod to the whole Mr. Robot world.
And I was like, guys, stop making fun of me, please.
In the car, there is a nod. This is the first nod, but not the first one I found, to the Mr. Robot world. She's on the phone with, I don't know if you guys are going to get to this. I'm sorry if I'm stepping on toes here.
No.
She's on the phone with like a colleague of hers. It sounds like someone who works for her. And she asks about the Confictura account. And I was just like, oh, what's that? I looked it up. That's the company that creates the Red Wheelbarrow restaurant.
No way.
On the notebook of Elliot's in season 2 when he's in jail.
There are so many like little references like that that come up in this series. I'm so excited to get into them.
The first place they go is Point Comfort, the grocery store in the small town. And I'm going to credit the Twitter account. It's Anne Hannah Jones, who picked up on a number of very specific references in this movie to the beginning of the slave trade in America, the African slave trade. And so Point Comfort, I'm assuming Americans learn this in school. I don't know if that's true, but I would say in Canada.
Might be a hard assumption there.
I would say in Canada, we don't learn as in-depth about this particular history, but she talks about that's a landing spot of the first Africans who were sold into slavery in Virginia. And so there's a fork in the road. They can go to Point Comfort, that's the grocery store, so to choose Comfort, or if they go left, they go to Fort Mose, which was the first sanctioned town of free black people. And so it's really fascinating where the parallel here is. She explains in her tweets that they can choose Comfort or they can choose slavery. So they choose Point Comfort. And there are going to be a number of other references to slave trade, like vessels and other things throughout the movie.
Indeed, that does seem to be a recurring theme. And I was kind of wondering, at this point in the movie, we're only like under 10 minutes in, I think. I was wondering, like, what do you think the symbolism is of that? Is it for them to refer to kind of choosing to work within a system that exists before them? Or some kind of like reaching for comfort instead of disability?
I admit that I'm still really chewing on how these references fit together, because this whole movie is about upheaval and the end of society as we know it now. And of course, our society has been built on the labor of enslaved peoples. And so the idea that, you know, there are all of these references to the beginning of that era, I'm not sure what that's supposed to signify for us. We would welcome listener input on what that symbolizes for us. Because the references, there are so many and they're so specific that they're obviously not accidental. But I'm not sure I've connected the big picture just yet.
I think I agree with that. And it might kind of help to kind of go a little bit further into the plot line here. As they're arriving at their beach house, I guess, it seems like quite a well-designed place. I wish I lived there. I can imagine how expensive the place would be, although they got to get a pretty good deal on it. As they're coming in here, they investigate some paintings on the wall. Those will kind of become relevant in the future, as we notice they change over time, which is a big kind of signifier about what's to come in the storyline. What did you think about the venue, like when they arrived there? Did it give you any like creepy vibes, positive vibes?
Well, the soundtrack is super creepy. So they're on the beach and it's too quiet. Like the beach, like a question mark I have here is why is no one on the beach?
It almost makes you think they know better. I was getting some like flashbacks to watching Jaws. I've just been afraid of beaches ever since watching that.
And I think Matt Quayle also did the soundtrack for this movie, right?
Yeah. That's right. It was also, I think a cinematographer and another executive producer were workers on Mr. Robot who collaborated again for the series.
And so they do a very good job of creating this sort of ominous environment because before we know it, a boat, a huge tanker crashes right up on the shore. The tanker's called the White Lion. That, again, is a specific reference to a ship that carried enslaved peoples.
Yeah, and I was kind of... as I was watching this, I just couldn't really tell where the show was going to go from here, because it gives you a lot of apocalyptic vibes, but it also gives you a lot of almost like psychological horror coming along with it. Like all these people aren't reacting. They're just slowly walking away from this gigantic tanker coming crashing into the beach. From this point on, like I had no idea what to expect.
And also the Wi-Fi is out. And I think what I learned from watching many seasons of Mr. Robot is that that's not a good sign. That's never a good sign if your Wi-Fi is out.
Right. And it's not just the Wi-Fi, but we'll see that they start to lose other forms of communication, even the power, things like that, as the story goes on.
This is the first time we see the deer. Because there are deer that kind of congregate in the yard. And that's... We're quite quickly getting all of these signals sort of layering on top of each other that something is really terribly wrong. And so one thing I did is I did look up, I was like, what do deer symbolize in different mythology over time? Deer in Shinto mythology are considered to be messengers. So they bring messages from higher powers, which I thought might be interesting. And in Slavic mythology, deers represent the sun. There's this like image that a big antlered deer is the like one who brings the sun. So anyway, I just thought those were like some sort of interesting things to know. And I'd be curious too if other people have a sense of what other cultures think a deer symbolizes.
Well, one thing that I noticed listening to the book, in addition to watching the series beforehand, was that from the very beginning, they tell the reader that the deer are present in the thousands. From the very first time you see them, it's just that the characters don't see them, but to the reader, we're told that they're already there, like in mass numbers. It shows that they are evacuating, like migrating to another more hospitable environment. And that kind of made like the hairs on my neck raise, because you know, if these animals are being driven to migrate away, like there's something that probably humans should be aware of too.
And you're going to see that throughout the movie, because there are like flocks of geese who are migrating, even though it's not migration time. And there are all of these other symbols from the animal world. And you're right, humans don't know how to interpret them or what to make of them. But the deer seem to be the most present and the most unnerving.
Yeah.
So this is the first time that we see the deer. Now the family's kind of settled in, and that's when we get a stranger at the door.
Yeah. What was your expectation when the character came in here? Or are they the characters? Because I think this was a moment when the series could have went off in like two very different directions that were either character-based or action-based or horror-based. But they picked a very particular way to go when they introduced these characters.
So I assumed it was going to be just some strangers in need of help, perhaps. They're dressed like very, very formally. So I was like, oh, is this someone whose car is broken down or what's going on? But they actually have a much more personal connection to
indeed. They say it is their house. And this is something that's raised more explicitly in the book, but the folks who are coming in and renting this Airbnb are initially skeptical that the people actually do own the house. They're kind of wondering, like, is this somebody who is actually telling me the truth, or are they just trying to get access to a place that I consider safe?
And the way it's framed in the movie is that, well, so the children are in bed. Ethan Hawke is super chill about it. And this is where Amanda is the only one questioning. And the way that it comes off, especially because it's a black family who arrives, is that there is like a racial dimension to her distrust. I don't know if that. Yeah. Okay. So that did seem that way to others. And so it's a tough one because you wonder why she doubts them, because there is a part of you that thinks, oh, it would be reasonable to doubt a stranger that arrived at your door with no ID, whose name didn't match the name they had used in speaking to you. But also it's framed in a way that you're like, oh, no, she's wrong. Like, why is she being so critical? Just let them in. Let them into the house. I will say they try to, like, the Mahershala Ali character, like, he has keys to cabinet within the house. So he offers them $1,000 back of the money they paid to rent it. And that's also where we see Chekhov's gun in the drawer.
Right. So it does show that they have some kind of knowledge of this place. It doesn't really reveal how they got it, though.
And we have to live with that uncertainty for a little bit. And so do all of the characters. We do catch we've learned that there's an emergency broadcast. There's a national emergency.
I have a bit of trivia about that national emergency, actually, which is that there was a kind of like emergency broadcast protocol that was used before the late 1990s, I believe. And that's what's shown on the screen here. So it's technically like anachronistic because it wouldn't exist at this point in time. But right now it's illegal to use the actual emergency broadcast system in artwork because it could confuse people and make them think that there's an actual emergency going on, you know, like the war in the worlds. So they use the old version of that emergency broadcast system for this, even though it's not technically correct because it doesn't resemble one that they would actually use.
So I actually wrote down, I was like, I think you are much closer to accuracy than I am on this, because what this reminded me of was that during the 1991 coup attempt on the USSR, they cut all of the broadcasting and they played the ballet Swan Lake on this long, long loop.
Huh.
Wouldn't know what was going on. And so I was like, oh, is this like that where they're just broadcasting? Because there's this conversation about how the kids don't know what reruns are. Just broadcasting this so that people won't be alarmed that there's like something happening in the background. But I think if there is in fact an actual emergency broadcast system like that, you're probably more on the money.
Right. Yeah. And I remember doing something like that this one time. I was on a movie set kissing Cassandra Bullock and outrunning a speeding bus.
The bus that couldn't slow down?
The bus that couldn't slow down.
I just want to point out, too, weren't the notifications from her CNN app?
Oh, were they?
I thought that's what I saw. I watched the movie twice. I could have sworn. And that's what struck odd with me is that it wasn't an emergency broadcast message, that it was like a news app that was saying things. So it's like, is it even legitimate?
We do kind of draw that into question later because we might be getting ahead of ourselves, but these messages are distributed in different languages to different people. Just to kind of get back on track, where were we in the storyline?
So we're in the story where both families are staying in the house. You get the sense that GH and Ruth, so they're the family who own it, they want the other family to leave, but they don't want them to be frightened. They want them to think everything's okay and to go peacefully. So we know, the viewer knows, the families are at odds.
Right. And they are both kind of seeking the same reward here. So neither of them wants to give up what they have and risk kind of someone else invading on that, especially considering the danger that could be outside. It does kind of make one wonder, like, what are their motivations? What are they trying to protect? In contrast to the book, the TV series has GH caring for their daughter, whereas in the book, GH has a wife, and they have a daughter who is not shown in the series, but they are trying to like get back to and save. But in the TV series, they kind of bring the daughter to be the secondary character there.
Right. And the daughter is really preoccupied with the idea of like a power plant failure, and references, remember that thing that happened in New Jersey a few years back that nearly caused a meltdown? So there's another Mr. Robot.
Right. There are so many Mr. Robot references that come up, but it's notable that none of those are in the book. They are all Esmail's additions.
I like how they've been able to overlay that universe onto this book. Did you think it was overlaid in a relatively like congruent way? Like, does it make sense to you having read the book as well?
The way I see it is that there are a lot of common themes between the two, but it does kind of seem to me that there was kind of a novel that was written 90% of the way there. And then Sam Esmail kind of stuck in the last 10% that was connecting it back to the universe that he's worked on before. I think that it's very worthwhile as a standalone title. And then when you add the additional layers on top of that, like, you can get even more connection out of it. But it is clear that wasn't there from the beginning.
I think that makes sense. Just a conversation I had with my wife about the movie was like, there are all these little Mr. Robot pieces that are in there that if you don't catch, you're not going to really miss anything. Right. So the story of the book stands alone on its own very well. And then Esmail kind of sprinkles his little universe on top of it.
It's interesting to see them fit together. And I'm going to have to read the book after this. The next, I think, significant part of the story is Ethan Hawke. I think his name's Clay is the character. Goes out looking for some information. And that's when a plane flies over. There's also a really heart-wrenching scene where he comes across a woman who's obviously in some distress and makes a choice not to help her.
Yeah, and especially looking back at that scene retrospectively, it really spelled out what the sentiment is between this entire movie. Because I think that it reflects how when there's a breakdown of communication, it removes our ability to empathize with other people. I think that these characters, they would really be on the same page if they could even communicate what they were saying to each other. But because of that language barrier, they just can't. And it leaves them both in a very difficult position where one of them is running away and one of them doesn't understand why. But it's because neither of them can really do anything for each other.
Artistically, they've reflected that because the Spanish speaker is not subtitled. So if you are a viewer who does not speak Spanish, her message also remains opaque and unknown to you. And so also we would welcome Spanish-speaking listeners to help us understand what that character tries to communicate in that really, that's a really sad moment. That's a really hard moment. And it's sort of, the plot propels away from it very quickly because as he's speeding away from this woman, a plane is flying overhead and you're not sure. Actually, it's funny. I have a plane is spewing red smoke and then I have smoke crossed out and then I have confetti written in and then I have confetti crossed out and then I have flyers. So you don't know if it's a government distributing information or what's going on.
Yeah. And there hasn't really been very much in the plot line before this to tell us what to expect. In fact, what we see ends up just raising even more mysteries. When we bring these papers back to see Danny later on, we find out that they aren't even what we expect to see here.
Now, GH is on a mission to the neighbor's house. He knows they have a satellite phone, which he tries to use, but there's no signal for that phone either. I'm a bit perplexed. So he's there. A plane crashes onto the beach. I'm a bit perplexed why no one else seems to hear it.
I was also thinking this was a bit of a moment of artistic license. It did have some amazing visuals, I can say that. But there are moments where GH like sees the watch in the sand and then he pulls it up. And not only is it attached to an entire arm that he didn't see, but there are like 500 dead people who he didn't see. And that kind of does stretch plausibility. But I think that it's more kind of telling us like, what are the feelings of this character right now? What are they focused on? What can they struggle to believe? And then when those things kind of come crashing down, as I do with the water smashing against the doorway that GH is in, we kind of like are forced to confront those things.
Now, GH also starts to begin alluding to the market predictingness, or do we learn exactly what he does?
No, but actually I want to interject, just to break up the flow here. So what's her name? Julia Roberts' character, Amanda, is chatting with the daughter during this time when he's out looking for the neighbors. And that's when we see another Mr. Robot tie-in where Amanda's been reading Beach Towel.
Oh, yeah. I meant to bring up Beach Towel. Thank you for mentioning that. Yeah, because there are all of these references that kind of directly tie it into the Mr. Robot universe.
Yeah, that's the book she's been reading this entire trip is Irving's Beach Towel.
That's hilarious. I love that.
What do you think Irving would be up to right now?
Irving?
He's safe.
Yeah, he's living a good life. I want to say in Romania or something.
I feel like he would be on the Frasier reboot, possibly.
I mean, I'd watch. This is a pretty action-packed sequence. There's quite a lot that goes on here. So we talk about GH, we talk about Ethan Hawke, we talk about Archie gets a tick. It's kind of a gross scene.
Yeah.
And so he gets a tick while they're walking in the woods. There's more deer. This is where the geese all start to migrate. I also have a note here that says, I have to believe that Ruth's tattoos are symbolic.
Especially considering how much symbolism is packed into this episode. Like, I have no doubt that all of them mean something, like down to the pixel.
I wish I had better insight on what those things were.
I do have something to add about one of the outfits that's, oh my god, I'm sorry. I read the book and I watched the show, but what's the son's name?
Archie.
Archie, yes. He wears one of the shirts that references Obey. The Shepherd Fairy artwork. Do you know what I'm talking about? Like the Andre the Giant has a posse thing too? Yeah. That is the artist who made the Obama Hope poster. And as we found out after watching this, Obama and Michelle Obama were executive producers for this series. So it's kind of like an inside joke that he also designed one of their most famous portraits.
I tried to read a little bit about the Obama's involvement, but that is a deep rabbit hole of people who believe wild conspiracy theories about why.
Yeah. yeah, let's not go down that rabbit hole because that will just drive us further into despair.
There's one piece here I want to touch on because this was a moment that made me really, truly sad. So Amanda and Clay are trying to protect their kids from knowing what's going on up to this point. GH gets back. He's telling Amanda about the plane and Ruth is eavesdropping. And there's a point where Amanda just talks about, because her mom is on a plane. So she's really afraid. And Julia Roberts just kind of puts it all out there for her. And I thought that is so sad that, like, this young, I guess she's a young woman, but, like, this black girl doesn't get to be protected from any of this information. But these rich white kids all get to be protected from what's going on. Like, there's no effort to conceal it from Ruth. Ruth is just supposed to bear it. And I just found that, I just felt very sad for Ruth in this scene.
Indeed, yeah. And as you mentioned, that actually, one of the things that is, I feel bad bringing this up, but in the book, one of the things that they do mention as a plot point is that in the past, racialized individuals would not be given analgesics or like painkillers during their medical treatment because they were expected to kind of be able to tough out those things. And that was something that actually is like pointed out in the book about how later on when a white character suffers some injuries, they can go get a doctor, but not everybody might have that privilege.
It's quite a striking scene and interesting that you raised that tie-in. Of course, a lot of this is about like who's in the in culture and who isn't. The flyers, that's what's flying out of the plane. They're written in what looks like Arabic text. And this to me actually was just such a like today moment where the kid's like, oh yeah, that says Death to America. I learned it in a video game.
Minecraft, yeah. In Minecraft, you talk about that all the time.
Oh, yeah. And so there's also, we should mention, we're going to come back to this a couple of times, there's reference to this sort of like local prepper.
Danny.
So we're going to come back to Danny. The family decides to go to New Jersey. And now, here's a Mr. Robot reference for you. Anybody want to talk about what they see on the road?
They have the self-driving cars, right?
And they're all white. And if you remember in the finale, every car in the neighborhood is a white car, a white sedan. And so they're homogenous as Elliot's running through the neighborhood. And so on the road, it's all white autonomous vehicles who've all collided with each other. There's no people.
And we can kind of infer that they are under control by another person or entity or whatever. But they all are behaving, suffice to say, against their best interest and the best interest of our protagonists here.
What's awkward is I realized at part three that there are like titles.
For each part?
Like part three is the noise. Mm-hmm. And so that's in reference to there's a scene where there's this like ear-piercing sound. I don't think we ever really learn what it is. But I think that's what finally propels the family to like get in the car and try to go. But then part four is the flood.
Mm-hmm. When you were thinking of the noise, they were connecting it to Havana syndrome and this kind of incident that happens in Cuban embassies where people were subject to what was speculated to be microwave radiation. Did you connect that to like those news stories when you were watching this?
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up because there was, and I'm going to lose the reference now, but there is a Havana syndrome reference in Mr. Robot as well.
Oh, no.
I just can't remember where it happened.
What's funny is that we probably recorded an episode about it, too.
I was like, I remember learning about it just for this show. So we have kind of a moment of levity here where we see people sort of like, they're like vaping, they're like drinking and dancing, and and because people have their guard down a little bit, that's when GH starts talking about, you know, his clients alluding to some like secret evil cabal that runs the world, but that it's actually worse than that because no one is really in control.
When you were watching this, did you start to think of like Deus Group at any points? Because we do have these connections to Mr. Robot. Is that who you thought that they were referring to?
Well, it's interesting because I thought it could be that, or it could just be, you know, some like relatively interchangeable Illuminati type idea.
Right.
But it is interesting to think about, you know, you can, there are all these allusions to who's really pulling the strings. I do want to talk about Rose and Friends for a minute. Did either of you watch Friends?
No.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
Unfortunately. Dave, why don't you tell us your favorite episode?
It's one of the Thanksgiving episodes where they play football. I think it's called the one where they play football.
Rose, she's the little girl, and she has like the Jennifer Aniston haircut. And her great fear is that with everything going on, she's never going to find out what happens to Ross and Rachel. What happens to Ross and Rachel?
Oh, they get together, don't they?
I've only ever seen about five episodes. I am asking.
Legitimate question here.
Yeah, the last one. Yeah, I'm pretty sure they get together because it's like, I don't think, was it NBC that does the show? I don't think they would let that go another way.
Yeah. And so here's what's interesting too. Ruth makes this comment about people love Friends because it's nostalgia for a time that never was. And I think that's a lot of the critique of Friends is that it's so artificial. Like, it's New York. It's this all-white friend group. They have whatever jobs, but they live in these huge apartments. They have lots of leisure time. Like, so Rose is very invested in this kind of nostalgia. I guess the way people talk about the good old days for a time that was really not that good or really certainly not that good for everyone.
Or that might have never really existed, right? It's kind of an idealized version of something that we wish existed but maybe never did.
This is also where we see the pool full of flamingos, which I think is just maybe the most stark example of kind of the upset in the natural world.
Right. I remember this scene because I checked out the trivia page on IMDb after seeing this, and flamingos actually can't take off from water. They're like wading birds who need to take off over like a long distance. So this doesn't make sense in the least. I'm sorry. And it happened both in the book and the TV show. Beautiful visuals, but just not accurate.
So this movie is about 2.5 hours long. It actually moved very fast for me. Did you feel it was long?
I felt like the first act and the third act were very fast, and the middle one dragged on a little bit. Because at the beginning, we kind of get right into the narrative of going out to this Airbnb, And then only like a minute or two later, you have a gigantic tanker crashing into the beach. It's more the center act that is kind of more character driven. And then in the third act, we get right back to that kind of action piece coming up.
Yeah. And so where it really starts to pick up for me is Archie, the son. So his teeth start coming out. And this scene is so upsetting for me. Everything with teeth. I also used to...
Nightmares, right?
We have, again, a nightmare like this.
It's a very common one that I have as well, yeah.
And I don't know if the suggestion is because of the tick. I don't know if the book says anything more about what's going on with the kid.
In both cases, the tick is kind of a red herring. It could be a connection, but it's not explicitly said one way or the other.
It's super disturbing, but this is where the group's kind of cleave. Also, Rose is missing, so the little girl's missing. The boy obviously needs medical help. The group kind of splits on gender lines here. And so the men decide they're going to go try to find help with the boy. And then Ruth and Amanda are trying to find Rose.
You know, I noticed that this was a fracture in like the sense of community that they've built up so far. But I hadn't noticed actually that it was divided along gender lines like you had mentioned. Do you think that there's any kind of symbolism that we can draw from that? Like that one of them is more concerned about protecting and one of them is more concerned about like safety and defensiveness?
You know, that's an interesting thought. So this is another point where I thought, oh, I noticed it. I don't think there are any accidents in Sam Esmail's works, but I don't exactly know what I think it signifies.
I think that's a pretty good analysis. The only thing I thought about was like the, you know, Amanda becomes Ruth's kind of mother figure in their time alone. Right.
Mm-hmm. And they've been working on that throughout the story beforehand.
Yeah. But I think Devlin's assessment there is pretty accurate to what the two groups are achieving, right?
Yeah. So this is very interesting insight because they, and especially for Ruth and Amanda, who have to find a way to cooperate, even though there's some tension between them, which I think is a classic mother-daughter sort of vibe. Let's talk about the men go to the house. So it's Danny, the prepper's house. He also just happens to be the contractor who did the renovations on GH's house and probably all of the local houses. So they know each other, but he steps out with a gun.
Yeah, and right away we kind of have an impression that this is not just a contractor. That actually seems to be giving GH and Clay here a bit of a harsh welcome, to say the least.
This is also... I don't exactly know what to make of this either, but essentially, you know, the men are there to ask for medical help because they assume this guy is super prepared for any kind of emergency. There's a point where Ethan Hawke basically says, I'm a totally useless man. Like, mm-hmm. I'm begging for your help. You are a prepared and capable man. And I thought, I think this scene says something interesting about masculinities and bargaining and survival. But again, I don't know, I have so many half-formed thoughts about this movie.
Yeah,
I've sort of got the beginning of the thread but not the end of it.
Yeah, well, I think in this confrontation between Clay, GH, and Danny, all of them have such incredibly different personalities and outlook about what's about to come ahead of them, and in a way they kind of reflect like different ideologies. To perhaps disappoint some listeners, I don't want to get into the specifics of what those ideologies could be, but they seem to reflect to me like differences of individualism and collectivism and like, can we trust outsiders or do we just need to rely on ourselves?
I like that analysis of it. I think that's interesting. It's also interesting because they reflect different ideologies. They interpret recent events differently. So, you know, Danny strongly believes that it's in fact Korean who are behind it, and you know, has word of a version of the flyer that was dropped with Korean words on it.
Or Chinese,
that's true. He also says it's perhaps Chinese.
Which looks nothing alike.
He also mentions the Russians and the Russians fleeing. So it's like he's casting this real broad net about the other.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's kind of interesting. I'm trying to think of anything else that's interesting in this scene. He does eventually decide to help them for a price.
Right. And he refers to it as bargaining or bartering, sorry. Bartering. Yeah, even though it's bartering for cash, which is, you know, what cash is for. But I think that the sentiment we're intended to take from this scene is that even the people who you can rely on for help are sometimes more concerned with themselves and cannot always be relied upon. It'll draw into question whether it is worth kind of relying on others or if we need to rely on ourselves, again, bringing back that question of individualism versus collectivism.
I think it shows a kind of a little bit of a misguided understanding of individualism. Like he's not the brightest guy, but he is right to be prepared. You know what I mean? As time goes on, he's probably going to need to rely on someone else. So can he keep up that kind of mentality, right?
Did it make either of you think of the episode of The Last of Us with Nick Offerman? Like the sentiment of like being able to live by yourself or needing to rely on other people?
No, because I liked that character.
Fair, yes.
Well, this is interesting because I think it also shows that a moment of crisis is too late to build community or build interdependence, mm-hmm. because all the cracks are going to show. So if the connections we have with each other are superficial or transactional, when the shit hits the fan, we'll find out exactly what those are worth to people. In this case, $1,000.
Yeah.
It's funny you bring that up, the $1,000, because I wanted to say, like, not only did we see Chekhov's gun, it didn't get fired, but it showed up again.
Right.
Yeah, and it's also Chekhov's $1,000.
Because it did have to be shot. So it's really interesting. And I do want to talk about the scene with the men in the car after they've secured the antibiotics. But I don't know if we should go back to what's happening with the women first.
Why don't we finish off the storyline with GH first? Sure. And then we can jump back and solve all one for all. Because I think that this scene... it's quite pivotal for kind of explaining to the audience what the movie is all about. We've had so many open questions, and so many of them remain open after this, but this discussion just gives us a bit of a hint of what they're trying to tell to us, I thought.
And so GH, International Man of Mystery, talks about being aware that this guy had done an illegal reno to build a bunker, a secret bunker at one of the neighbors. And he also says that one of his clients had let him in on a three-step program to essentially collapse a government from within. So the first is to disable communication. So we saw that when the Wi-Fi went out. Two is to synchronize chaos. So cause people to turn on each other, distribute misinformation. And then third, they describe as coup d'etat, civil war, total collapse.
And the third step will come naturally once the first and second are followed.
And he also says something about, you know, if a nation is dysfunctional enough, if the seeds are already sown for this, the work will do itself, essentially, once you start the plan in motion. Which makes you think about how precarious any of our societies might be or how vulnerable to such an interruption.
Absolutely, especially as we become more reliant on specific modes of communication and realizing how communication is so vital to cooperation. If we lose any of those ways to connect with each other, then things will just fall apart instantly. And we see that happen on screen here.
It makes me slightly worried that I literally can't get anywhere without Google Maps assisting me.
And barely with Google Maps, if I could say so.
Touché. All right. So they've secured antibiotics for the kid. They've had this very earnest conversation about how, well, they're forecasting essentially the end phase of what's been set in motion. And then I do think that wraps up that storyline. I think then we're back to Ruth and Amanda, right?
Indeed. And this is a bit of like a bonding moment between these characters. In the past, they haven't really been able to get along very well, but we see that under stress and needing to rely on each other, they do connect more than those other characters in those other scenes had just before.
I had thought until this point that Rose was the only one who could see the deer, but now I realize it is all of the women see the deer.
Oh, well, you're right, actually. And I was noting earlier that like in the books, they mentioned that there are many more deer than are initially seen, but they are only seen by the women in both cases. So that is important to notice.
And there's this really, so they're in the shed. They're kind of rooting around because earlier they had found this kind of mysterious like imprint of where someone had been sleeping. And they're trying to find the little girl. And that's when I don't even know how many deer, hundreds of them kind of corner Ruth.
Yeah. And it does kind of lead to a tense standoff. I was thinking a lot of this scene that we had seen in Toronto of the runaway kangaroo who was escaped from a zoo and punched some police officers. And I was kind of wondering, are the deer going to get into fisticuffs here?
Well, I think that's the, and it's kind of an unnerving scene. Like you're not sure if they're just going to like stampede over them. And there are so many, and obviously they are unarmed. And this, I think, is where Amanda steps in and acts. So she just starts screaming and making herself as big as she can and trying to frighten the animals away. And they do disperse.
Right, because they both kind of, I think Julia Roberts' character takes initiative and realizes what has to be done, and she steps in to kind of try and save the day. But ultimately, it's their cooperation and working together that does diffuse the situation.
And to make an unnerving scene even more unnerving, so they, of course, they're walking through the woods. They've had some bicycle tracks. They think they're on their way to find Rose. But over the water, they can see the city, and you can see multiple explosions. You can see jets. You can hear shots. It looks like things are really an awful lot worse back in the city.
And the way that this shot is played out over several back and forth takes of Julia Roberts' face and the skyline of New York City, it really nails it in. Like, this is a big thing that's happening. You can feel how all the characters are taking it in. It's devastating to them. I was wondering, what do you think, this is intended to symbolize? Is it, a nuclear attack? Or is it a terrorist attack? Or what's kind of going on? Or what are they seeing?
So because of the allusion to, a civil war, I honestly assume it's maybe people fighting each other for resources. Or, I assume it's something, from within the country.
I think that's fair to say, because I did see some people online who were saying that this was a nuclear attack from another country, but it doesn't really appear to depict that to me. This seems more like something that is kind of coming from within, like you had noted.
Well, and because I think, because of the misinformation, the pamphlets and the different languages and things, where I feel like that's to frame it as a threat from outside or a threat from some other non-American source, but the threat, I think, if we follow GH's thinking, the threat is very much coming from inside. So that's how I took it. I think there's different ways you can interpret it, though.
Yeah. So speaking of different ways to interpret things, we see that Rose is coming up on this house that she has been looking for kind of throughout the duration of the film. What were you expecting when she came into there?
So I assumed she was going to find the bunker.
So you knew that right away?
That was my instinct, that she was going to someplace safe.
Yeah.
I want to ask you, too, if you liked the ending.
I loved the ending. I thought it was awesome.
I also love the ending.
Well, what I loved about the ending was that it leaves so many open questions. I think that it kind of rather than being a beginning, middle, and end, you go up to the top of the roller coaster and then you go down and you have these thrills, it brings you just up to the top and then it leaves you to fill in the blanks after that, because you are left to wonder, does everybody survive? What are they going to do? Do they all get to have this peaceful life in the bunker with the food and the television and so on? Because it kind of sets up something for you to think about without giving you any answers. And the fact that it doesn't give you any answers just makes it even more curious.
I also think it brings her character, which is not as well developed as the others through the movie, it really brings it full circle, because Rose is now in nostalgia land. Rose is in a house full of food and snacks and 90s DVDs. like Rose is in the time that never was, like the time that doesn't exist anymore. She's in this like sheltered bubble, which is where she was when she was watching Friends.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like to me, it like makes her vision real. Like she is back in her like safe 90s place. And because she's in quite a privileged social position, she can occupy it.
Do you think that she eventually reconnects with her family?
So I wonder that. I was like, does the family find her? Or does she eventually get lonely and go outside? Part of me thinks they have to find her because they've been talking about the thorns and the bunker. And I think everyone will converge there. But of course, who knows who else is in the woods?
Amanda and Ruth find the house. They find the house, though. They know it's there. And then they look over and New York's being bombed.
So you mean they're already on the way there?
Yeah. They say that Ruth must have gone this way, and they see the bike trail, and they see the house, but then they look over, and that's when they see the skyline of New York City getting bombed. And then GH and Clay have talked about the house. So I think they all end up there, and that's why I think the ending worked so well, is because you could just end it on this character who, like Aaron said, was not very fleshed out, is the only one who achieves her task in the entire movie.
Yeah. And by kind of showing there's like a long take of the bicycle outside the door to this mansion, I think it kind of symbolizes like all the work that Rose put in to having this be their future. Like it wasn't something that they stumbled upon. They saw a goal and they reached out to it successfully, which is really nice to see.
Well, it's funny because I feel like reviews of this have been mixed, but I felt like I really enjoyed it. Like I felt like it did take me on a journey. I still have, as I talked about, you know, a number of things I'd like to reflect a bit more on or questions that I still have. But in that way that it made me want to ponder those questions. Like it was a good story for building my curiosity. And I hope we'll see returns to this universe.
Yeah. Would you like to have a brief discussion about the connection to the Mr. Robot universe?
I think I've touched on all of the crossover points I caught. Are there any others that you folks noticed?
Well, one thing that I did notice in a practical sense was that Julia Roberts is portraying Heidi in Homecoming. Amanda, is that her name in the series? And Sam Esmail said that all of these films are in the same universe. So that kind of gives us a bit of like anthology kind of sense of the timeline that's going on here, where not all of these stories are connected directly. And again, I was thinking that this series was based on a book that did not originally have Sam Esmail involvement, but it was eventually adapted to have connections to that universe. I'm kind of wondering where they'll take it from here, if this will be developed into a full kind of anthology series, perhaps with some common actors portraying characters between them, such as in like American Horror Story. But I'm really excited about it. I think that it's great to see all the cinematography and score from Matt Quayle that we've come to expect from Esmail. And every time there's something new to watch, I'm always so excited to see it.
It's interesting that you raised Homecoming. Were there flamingos in Homecoming? There was something about a bird.
Yeah, I think that was one of the episode's names, actually.
And what?
It wasn't a flamingo, but it was a big... Was it a stork? It's a big beaked bird that made a weird noise.
Oh, yeah. Shit, we're going to need to edit this, but...
Sorry, I'm like, I'm on a rabbit hole. I should just let producer Dave have last thoughts and wrap up.
I did want to ask, so I do think that GH's client is somebody in the Deus group. I think it was... I just forgot his name, but it's... who it turns out being Angela's dad.
Oh, Price?
Price, yeah. I feel like he is the client because of the way GH talks about him and the way he kind of jokes, the way he wants him to hang out and drink, and the way he was kind of very serious about, you know, take care of yourself. It sounded very Price-like.
I like that thinking.
Sorry for the last minute. I have someone looking at what kind of bird that was. No luck. But I know what you're talking about, Dave, I swear.
Yeah, because the one guy knows what bird it is, and they catch it, right? They have like the whole episode's about the bird.
It's a whole motif. Like when there's that famous like shot of it going into the 4-3 into the 16-9, it has that bird playing in the background, and I feel so silly for not recognizing it.
I know, and I was like, I think it's not a clean link, but it made me think of it.
Well, it is now.
Well, I must say, it's a real pleasure to reunite and make this episode, and we're grateful to people who still follow us and interact with our show, and we hope that you will interact with our giveaway. And what are we asking people? Are we asking them what their favorite snack food is, or what their favorite episode of Friends was, or what their favorite large bird is? I don't know.
I would say your favorite regional snack that is available nowhere else.
It's tricky.
My regional snack would probably be Coffee Crisp. But it's like, is a whole country a region? Probably, yeah.
Yeah, that's good enough.
Is there, well, before we wrap, is there any other connections to the Esmail cinematic universe that we want to take a stab at?
I noticed there were many of them that were referencing like 5-9 and E-Corp. I didn't notice any of them that directly referenced characters from Mr. Robot, though. And one thing I was wondering, like, planes in Mr. Robot have been a common motif, and Dom's character storyline, for example, ended on her boarding a flight to Budapest. So I was thinking, like, I really hope she's not on one of these planes that's affected by this. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, I think there's supposed to be, like, 5 years of difference between those two incidents, so probably not. But planes always do give me a bit of anxiety, just from what we saw in Mr. Robot.
If listeners have caught any crossover points that we didn't, we would love to hear them, so be sure to share them with us. Thank you for listening to Mr. Rewatch. This episode was recorded between Toronto and Hamilton, Ontario. You can find us online at Mr. _Rewatch. Bonsoir.